A conference on artificial intelligence is underway this week in Waikiki. One of the workshops offered on the Big Island this past weekend was thanks to a group whose focus is robot-assisted search and rescue. Robin Murphy works with the organization and helped with advanced training for flying drones at night.
Because that's one thing, you know, you think about having helicopters and all of these things, but they don't fly at night, so you're blind. Emergency managers are often blind at night, and this is a great time to use those small drones. Very cost-effective, a lot safer, and it gets you the information you need.
So how were you able to use those drones?
The first night we flew, we surprised ourselves and everyone. We found a new fissure that had just opened up. Knowing about that 8 hours earlier than you would know any other way can help. The biggest one, I think, besides help trying to with some of the evacuation, the biggest one, I think, was the night when the lava finally decided to make a run to the sea. It began, you know how it was very, very slow, and then it really gained pace. When we were out with the USGS, David was flying. They were doing the estimates and noticed that we're taking measurements, and they could see that all of a sudden the rate was accelerating, and it would be 15 hours before was projected before it cut off the last of the ring road and to get people out of there. And they knew that meant civil defense knew about it 7 to 8 hours earlier than they would have if they had to wait till the morning for someone to fly over. And that gives more time to prepare, to notify people, to think how you're going to do this and get them out of there. So we're very pleased to increase the safety margin and help the civil defense and the emergency managers to make the best decision possible with the best information.
I recall that there was some incident where I thought maybe it was thanks to a drone that they were able to get a gentleman out in the nick of time.
Yes, yes. Bill Hansen was just interviewed on the PBS that NOVA came out, Hawaii on Fire. I recommend it to everyone to watch that. This was, for me personally, I think my 13th or 14th deployment with the unmanned aerial vehicles. I've been doing this since 1955. My first deployment was 9/11. For me, seeing the UAV, you know, you'd see some smoke over on the side, but it's on the other side of a stand of trees, and then you would bring the UAV up and realize, oh my gosh, that's a fissure right across that set of trees. We're in a neighborhood. It doesn't look that dangerous if you're on the ground, but once you see it, you realize how close and how potentially dangerous it is. And so for me, that was quite illuminating to see how the fissures in the lava work.
Yeah, because that bird's eye view, you know, that wide angle lens just gives you a perspective like no other.
Exactly. Being able to see how close it is. Because, you know, you're on the ground, you've got trees in between, you see smoke over there, or it may not even be a lot of smoke or plumes, so you have no idea of just what's over that hill and what that dangers or the impact might be. And so that gives, and being able to see that in real time. One of the things that we did was use FirstNet. There's a new cellular protocol that's being designed for first responders so that all the responders, the special chip, they'll get access, priority access to the cell network. Makes a lot of sense. Wonderful. Well, it's still new. They're working out the bugs. We were able to bring that from Texas A&M because that's one of our research areas at our school. Brought that over, and we're able to stream live video from the UAV into the civil defense, the EOC, Emergency Operations Center, so they could see what we're seeing. So now you don't have a couple of hours of passing data around in this. People can see in real time what they need to see. This also means that people are really good at flying, but may not be very good at geology, right, or what the ramifications are, can start getting information that they need rather than having to go out and stand next to a UAV pilot or wait for data to come in. And so that was very exciting to see those concepts mature.
So you can really mobilize the resources where you need it in an efficient manner.
That's right. And everybody has access to it. So, you know, with your emergency response, you have so many different functions. You have people who are worried about transportation. What is the status of the roads? You have people worried about, you know, fires. What's that? What are the fires doing? What are the what's the public safety doing? Where are the public works? How are the medical ambulances going to get in there? What's the medical ramifications of this? All of these different groups, even, you know, veterinarian, are there livestock in the area? Do we need to get that out? they now have much more information. And that's wonderful because, you know, the more you have and in a form that you can use means the better decisions. And that means more life-saving, more prevention of problems, so you even have less risk for either the people in the hot zone or the responders themselves. It means faster economic recovery. And those are all good things.
I'm just curious, with the equipment you brought from Texas A&M, was this lava viewing then, was it kind of proving ground for your equipment?
Well, the wireless equipment we brought from Texas A&M, Florida State, Justin Adams, some of our other pilots brought their own gear. Not really a proving ground for those because these are all, you know, prosumer, professional grade, but consumer available equipment because it's cheap. It works really well. And if you lose it, you know, crashes into a lava flow, no harm, no foul. It's not super expensive. Back in the day, when I first started flying UAVs, these things were like $70,000 to $100,000. So you didn't want to risk flying over water. You wouldn't have risked flying over a lava fissure to get that perfect view that a geologist needed or someone, an emergency responder, needed because it just was the cost of failure. It was just kind of like nobody was going to pay you back from that. But now when you're talking about these devices that are running $1,000 to $3,000, you know, something happens, it gets in a thermal, something bad, you know, it crashes into the lava, I can pay for it out of my pocket. I'm not going to be happy, you know, but it's no longer a deal breaker. And that means that small rural counties will be able to use these technologies efficiently without having huge costs.
I'm just wondering about the noxious gases, you know, and what effect that might have on the metal or, you know, just that kind of thing.
It didn't have much. Yes, they do, but, you know, when you're talking $1,000, who cares? And $3,000 to $10,000, again, for what you're talking about, and that was a great point. One of the things we did do that was another high point that I totally forgot about. Thank you so much for reminding me. Is measuring the sulfur dioxide reading, right? You've got those plumes, you've got steam, but you know there's some sulfur dioxide. You can't really tell it until you smell it. That's not a great way to detect. We took, and the UAVs were flying and carrying a standard SO2 meter and looking and recording. And there had been a lot of debate in the chem-bio response world whether that would work, whether the downdraft would totally hide any readings. You know, you think all those rotors changing up the airflow and all that. Turned out you did get reading, and you knew that whatever reading you got was going to be a little on the low side. So whatever reading you got, you could tell exactly where the borders of that plume were. And that was another useful thing that we saw over at Lalania State.
So I'm sure then it just must have been very gratifying to the scientists involved just to know that they were really doing a lot of good and helping the first responders with the best information available at the time.
You're absolutely right. It's so gratifying to help, but the most gratifying part to me personally is that they wanted to be trained. They wanted to adopt this. It wasn't like, yeah, it worked great. It's like, it worked great, and we want it ourselves now. Train us in that. And that to me is the big win. It's not about us flying in from the mainland to help anybody or flying to another state. It all needs to be in the hands of every emergency responder. And that's the mission of the Center for Robot Assisted Search and Rescue. It's a nonprofit. We're just trying to get this technology into their hands. If they don't have the money and they need to see it, we'll bring it to you. If you need training, there we are. That's what we do. All about getting the science, the advances, into the hands of people who can really make a difference and save lives and save communities with it.
That was Robin Murphy, professor at Texas A&M. She's also with the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue. She was in Hawaii along with Florida State University's David Merrick, teaching a class on advanced drone flying at night, getting smart on searches. It was part of a conference on artificial intelligence taking place at the Hilton Hawaiian Village in Waikiki.